podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the weekend, and it is the Anfield Wrap. It is all the digest that you need as this week draws to a, well, not that dramatic a conclusion. Liverpool aren't doing a great deal, but we will talk about what they have done. We will also talk about Rafa Benitez. In amongst this as well, we'll have a little look at the Euros, and we've got Carl Kopak and Andy Pescalidis. I fancied that before, didn't I, Andy? I was in the office, I was so confident I'll do that in one.
I mean, I did say, do you want me to actually send you the spelling and all that? He said, nah, I've got it.
Pascalidis, there we are. I've got it now. But in that moment, it just wasn't there.
Well, you know what I mean? False start.
False start, but we will power through. And Andy Pascalidis will be joining you to talk about defibrillators, which is also difficult to say. With Carl Kopak, relatively easy to say. But you've got to be careful with those C sounds. Carl's done a great job on that interview that is to come. But we will start this off by talking about a little digest piece that Neil Jones wrote for Goal, but which had a couple of interesting little nuggets in a Neil Jonesy way. I'll come to you first on it. I've got Harriet Pryor, by the way, Chloe Bloxham and Andy Heaton, who you've already heard. I'll come to you first on it, Harriet. The players we're looking at, there was a few names that have been doing the rounds. You know, we're sick of them. We know the names by now. A little bit of Yves Bissouma over here. Cast your eye that way. There is a tiny, tiny little bit of John McGinn, possibly. The one that sort of struck me as, ooh, I've not really heard much tell around that before, was suddenly Harvey Barnes, big admirers at Anfield. He's injured at the end of the season. He's a remarkably exciting footballer, I think, Harvey Barnes.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because, like you said, it's not a name we've been linked with before. I've heard so much Neuhaus in the last sort of month and a half that I just want him to either sign or just say he's not coming to Liverpool because, you know, either way, at least it would rule it out. But it's good for the award-winning gutter, so we'll go with it. But yeah, Harvey Barnes is quite an exciting one. I think in terms of sort of similarities to players we've already got, kind of like a Jota figure. I mean, how old is he? Is he 23? So still relatively young player. I think he would blend in quite well. And I think he's sort of a project player. And we know that Klopp likes someone who's sort of on the verge of becoming something really, really great. And, you know, especially, I think we might talk about it later, but Manu obviously just signed Sancho. I think we're in need of someone young, someone a bit more exciting, a forward that can come in and make a bit of an impact. And also just a younger player that can start to develop and provide backup for the front three, because we know that, you know, even last season, the front three had times when they weren't performing at their best, and we could have really done with someone a bit younger coming in while Jota was injured as well, which didn't help anything. So, yeah, I think it's quite an exciting name and one that I haven't seen before and want to hear a bit more about.
He's an absolute tank, Andy. This is one of the things I like about him. He's got all the touch, all the technique. He's got finishing ability in there. Gets 9 league goals last season in a number of games. But he is an absolute tank as well. He's got an enormous head. And that's one of the things I'm looking for from wide midfielders.
He's also got an enormous arse.
Yep.
Which is up on my list of...
He's a unit, I think, Barnes.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I've been trying to have a quick look about his contract situation at Leicester. Because we know Liverpool love to have a little diddle on the hour contracts. And also, Patson Daka signing for Leicester. I think the thing behind that was, oh, well, Vardy's getting older. It's the legs of Vardy, but Leicester is still very much active. You're a much bigger fan of him than me, mate, because you've seen a lot more of him than me. But what he does have, and what I do like about him, is his speed of thought more than anything, which I think is what... Sometimes you kind of miss out on a player. And I always go back. It reminds me of the Traore / Jota links last year when everyone had linked us with the Adama Traore, who technically has got pretty much everything in his locker when he's on his game. And Jota just kind of come from nowhere. And I think that if you would have asked Nair, I think if you would have sampled 100 fans of any team last year, who would you rather sign? I think Traore's the clear winner. When you look at Jota and the way Liverpool played, it's speed and transitions, and that's what I can see with Harvey Barnes. Come back to me. I'm going to try and find when his contract
2024
is it?
Yeah, 2024. Oh, so there is still 3 years on his deal.
What money are you talking?
Well, I think you'd be talking 50 mil, but maybe a bit more, and you've got the injury risk in there. But the other part of it for me, Andy, which is interesting, as you mentioned Daka there, they've done Bertrand today, they're doing Sumar Leicester. One of the things I saw a journalist who covers Leicester say today was Leicester are doing really good business, but you've got to think at some point there's going to be at least one out. And that's something what I began to think, and there's always been a lot of chat about Maddison going to X, Y, or Z, but Maddison at the minute feels like, I don't quite know what the market for Maddison is right now, whereas I can see what the market for Barnes is, and I can especially see it at Anfield.
Yeah, 100%, and maybe that's Leicester's model to fund this. And you tend to think when teams tend to do deals early, and Liverpool have been experts at it in the past.
Yeah,
they instead of waiting for price to go up, they've got, right, we definitely want X, Y, and Z done early, and then later in the window to fund that, we will do this. So I mean, God knows if it. I've got no idea whether there's a possibility, but if it did, it's not one that I'd be particularly upset with. Let's just say there.
He does his other names, Neil, within there. He mentions Neuhaus, of whom Harry has had enough, like an architecture student sick of the Bauhaus school of design.
Not him, just his name.
Just his name.
Yeah.
There is Yves Bissouma. We Bissouma'd early. We haven't Bissouma'd that much recently. John McGinn has had a bit of shout because he looks tidy during the Euros. Renato Sanchez.
I wouldn't do the whole. I'd run the Mersey with no kicks on if we sign McGinn, but I just don't think it's likely at all. Sorry, just
no, it's not. I cannot see a signing
highly
McGinn.
Unlikely.
But Renato Sanchez has had a little bit of chat that feels to me like there could be something in it. And now
another big arse.
And Graven Birch is also in the IX teenager. Now Graven Birch does well when he comes to Anfield this season, and in the two games against Liverpool looked like a really good player. The one thing I would say is in the same games, and they're approaching sort of similar ages, I thought Curtis Jones was better than him. And that's a bit of a reminder at times as to where your squad actually is in terms of where you are for ins and outs.
Yeah, I think Graven Birch is a brilliant player. He's got good stature on him as well. His potential could be through the roof. But as you just said, you know, Curtis Jones has several of the times when we've played them and through the Champions League, he's shone as well. And we've got to remember that although he may not be the main starter for the midfield, he will be consistently in there because he will be brought off the bench. But you mentioned Renato Sanchez there, and I've always liked Renato Sanchez. He won the league, didn't he, with Lille, I think it was, last season. I've always liked him. And, you know, the Euros have proved how good of a player he is. And he reminds me of Gini so much. The thing I think of with Gini is he gets his body in between the ball and player and he turns and no one can get near him. The strength, you know, there'll be three players around you and you'll think, how the hell is he getting out of this? And somehow he comes out with the ball because of his strength. And I think Renato Sanchez has shown that. I think there was one part where he just backed into a player and he went absolutely flying off them. And it was very fun to watch. And
Emery Chan, wasn't
it? It might have been, and that's even more of a laugh. I absolutely can't stand that kid either. Yeah, both of them looking really, really good. If I was to choose, I'd pick Renato, but Graven Birch is a young, upcoming talent.
The problem I've got with the Renato Sanchez thing is just a general tournament thing. I'm always worried about signing a player after a decent tournament, but also in that particular position, that Granit Xhaka has looked fantastic.
Yeah. And it's a fully tournament, this one. I think the standard's been... We'll come on and talk about it, but I've not thought, Andy, the standard is earth-shattered and far from it. A lot of these games, to me, have looked like bottom-half Premier League games.
They've been attritional with little bits of quality dumped in, but even Pogba's passing, the amount of raking passes we've seen midfielders make who've played in the Premier League, and you're just not getting anywhere near them.
And you're not getting that time in the Premier League.
That's what I'm saying. So maybe there is a little bit of that, but maybe that's just my bias towards it. I mean, Sanchez has obviously got quality there. You look at the teams he's played for, but then you also look at the teams that he's played for and not done very well in. I mean, I remember it was the last Euros when he was the hot shit.
Yeah.
If you remember. And he's not really come on to be proven wrong, but I'd just be very, very... I'd want a lot more information.
Yeah.
Gravenberch is interesting, I think, in that it feels almost like he could even just be a little bit too young for what we're looking for. But he's now, because he's at Ajax, if we let him go and his trajectory is what you think his trajectory could be, and what we've seen, and you've seen him in the past, Andy, he's played at a really youth level at Anfield. If his trajectory is what his trajectory could be, there's a speed at which he could almost become a bit priced out for Liverpool. So it feels a little bit like it's not quite now or never, but it's arguably the next 18 months or never.
Yeah, and again, it feels like I'm pouring cold water on everything. But for players to develop, they need to play. They need to get minutes. Now, are you telling me this kid's that good? I'm not saying you are, but is the kid that good that he can come in and play 20, 30 games a season? I mean, we've seen this with Curtis Jones. When Curtis has had a run of games, he's markedly improved every game. And then when he's been out for a little bit, he's been a little bit, not lackadaisical, that's the wrong word, but not as sharp.
Yeah.
So that would be my concern. I think Liverpool are at the stage now, if they... we're going to go into the market for a midfield to replace Ronaldo. They need to go in with the mindset of get someone who's really, really young. So in that case, Graven Birch is too old. Or get someone who, you know, they could be fit to play 20, 30 games straight in.
The issue, though, Harriet, is that Liverpool do have a risk of regression. And I'm not even going from last season. I'm going from 1920. You know, if you almost pretend that the whole of last season doesn't happen, and we know about the mitigating circumstances. But within that, there's been a direction of travel around e.g. Jordan Henderson's injuries, prior to, you know, don't even include 2020, 2021. You know, there's a direction of travel in general there. There's wear and tear. There's literally what they went through, a lot of these footballers, between 2018 and 2020 to win the Champions League and the league title. It is a minor concern, isn't it, that this Liverpool side may well, if it isn't careful, have regressed a little bit more than maybe even the coaching staff are aware of at this stage, because it's a thing that just happens to footballers.
Yeah, I think it is a bit of a concern, and especially when I think last season has made us all look forward with extra amount of caution. I don't think we need to sort of be as cautious as we would have been, you know, previously, because last season was mad. I don't think we can say that was a sort of normal amount of injuries that we got. We were particularly unlucky. So I think it's an interesting one in terms of, I don't think we're really going to know what stage this squad is at until they're back in pre-season and start playing again and start getting the squad together. And I think that's almost why Klopp has been a bit sceptical to make any moves on any transfers particularly early, because he just genuinely doesn't know at this point what the state of some players are going to be like. What, you know, what are Naby Keita going to be like? What is Ox going to be like? What are the players returning from injury? Virgil, Gomez, what state are they going to be in? And then sort of if he's going from there, building the team, seeing what they're all like, and then maybe that's when we bring a few more players in. But we have got a more aging squad now, we know that, and I think that is why it's been quite important that we are being linked to those players around the 23-25 mark, because they are the ones that are going to come in and be sort of, you know, the Liverpool players of the future. So, you know, it is interesting, but at the same time we have things like, you know, Fabinho, Thiago and Henderson played 90 minutes together last season. If they form a more of a bond together next season, then I think it's got every potential to be an amazing sort of run. But we just have to wait and see what happens, and I think that's the frustration from the coaching staff and from the fans at the moment.
The demands are high, Chloe. They're up against the European champions, last season's European finalists, reigning league champions, who've won three of the last four and broken 90 points on two of those occasions, and a Manchester United added with Jadon Sancho before you look anywhere else. The demands are high for this Liverpool side. I think that they know what the demands are. I think that one of the things that's been really clear with Klopp since the moment he's almost arrived at Liverpool, I think he's known he's got to be looking at 90 points plus against a Pep Guardiola charged Manchester City. So I don't think they'll be under any illusions what the demands are, but there is a lot to be done. They've got to hit the ground running, and he normally likes to have his players in early, is the other thing I'd say.
Yeah, he does, and you've seen that with Konate. And I think the only difference maybe between defence and midfield is you saw what happened last season. You see that Joe Gomez can be injury prone, Joel Matip can be injury prone, Nat Phillips can bring some money in for another transfer, Reece Williams maybe go out on loan. And then you've obviously got Virgil, who is your main vocal point for this football team, alongside Jordan Henderson. I think the problem with midfield is you look at our substitutes for midfield. You've got Shaqiri, who plays there, injured quite a lot of the time. Chamberlain, injured quite a lot of the time. You've got Naby Keita, who for me doesn't see the light of day anymore, because I remember he went on a pre-season friendly and, you know, first class playing, and all of a sudden he was out for a month with an injured neck because of being on a football plane, and I'm like, he's ain't the mick. Like, that's a bit ridiculous, that. And I think that's the difference where, with midfield, you just never know if you've got those players available. It's not the fact that they don't have the talent, it's that if you can rely on them. And Jürgen Klopp likes to get everything done with time to spare, but I have a feeling that, you know, with the Euros here, obviously some things can't be done till after the Euros, because a lot of players are focused on trying to do their best in that competition, and fair enough. And maybe deals are near the final stages, but not and will get over the line until, you know, the final whistle's gone and someone's named champions of Europe. So that's another factor in the way. And the other factor is, I feel like this Liverpool side, this Liverpool squad, you need to make money to use it. And that is our philosophy. And to do that, these players need to have a good tournament. You need to show them off. Then you get the money for them, and then you try and look. But Jürgen Klopp will most definitely have those people in mind. It's just when they're out of the competition and everything can be finalised, that's when it'll all be apparent to everyone.
Chloe, they're spending the Jadon Shaqiri money before it's even in the bank. Coming up in a second or two, it's Carl Kopak and Andy Paskalidis on defibrillators. Back in a minute.
Hello. We were all shocked a few weeks ago to watch on our screens what happened to Christian Eriksen. If you've been living on another planet, he collapsed on the pitch during the game against Finland with what looked like at least a sudden cardiac arrest. At this point, we don't know what's happened to Christian, but he's okay. That's the main thing. Thanks to an expert medical team, and I think probably some of the most impressive footballers I've ever seen in my life about that. sadly, this is not an isolated incident. We can all remember a few years ago, Fabrice Muamba, then playing for Bolton Wanderers at Tottenham, collapsed on the pitch and his heart stopped for 78 minutes. He was helped by someone in the crowd at the time and survived. Mark Vivian Foe, who was then on loan at Manchester City in 2003, wasn't so lucky. He collapsed on the pitch at a Confederates Cup game against Colombia and didn't make it. He didn't survive. Reports, an autopsy, we found out later on that he had a condition called HCM, and that wasn't picked up in a scan. This is not an isolated incident. They're the most high-profile cases of this happening, but it has also happened to other footballers. And I'm joined by two people today from Australia. This has happened to someone they know, but some good has come of it. So I'm joined, first of all, by Amanda Joy Allen from the Liverpool Official Supporters Club of New South Wales. And I'm going to try again, Andy, from Andy Paschalidis.
Perfect.
For taking that, for having that. That's a win.
You've been to the Greek islands, obviously.
I have indeed, yeah. I read a lot of it of Homer. Andy from the Heartbeat of Football, and we'll be coming to him to say how they would have dealt with this in Australia. Amanda, you and I spoke a few years ago. You alerted me to a story that happened to a man called Mickey Dean, which I wrote for my own website. Can you tell us Mickey's story?
Yeah, I was involved with the official Liverpool Supporters Club at the time of Mickey's passing. But not only that, he also played for my local football club. So Mickey was midway through a game, had scored a cracker of a goal, headed goal, and complained of feeling unwell, came off the pitch, collapsed, was worked on, luckily, you know, at the time by a paramedic from his team, but unfortunately didn't make it. And having seen the firsthand that sort of impact that it has on a local community club, the people, the friends, the family within that, was able to use I suppose my position with LFC New South Wales, because Mickey was a really big red. He'd been to games in Europe with his dad. We were able to sort of look at going, what can we do locally in the community to help in these situations? And that's which led us on to Andy starting Heartbeat of Football around the same time. And really happy to say that we've been with them from the beginning, from LFC New South Wales' point of view.
So what were the resources before Mickey, as it were? I mean, did you have a defibrillator or an AED, as we call them here, or
standard
paramedics?
Yeah, that's the thing which Andy will be able to touch more base on, that it wasn't defibrillators in local football grounds. You know, they're in corporate buildings, but they weren't in sports fields in New South Wales, where, you know, thousands of people are playing of all age groups every weekend.
Wow. And didn't you say there was an incident before, Mickey, when someone had an attack or something?
There had been others, which Andy will have a lot more of that information as well. But, you know, to now have that at the ground is incredibly reassuring for all of every club on the Central Coast. Almost every club in New South Wales now has a defib at the ground since Mickey's death and a number of other deaths that year.
Which is excellent. Andy, before I come to you, I should say I have to sort of declare my own interests here. I work for the British Heart Foundation, who have in the past part funded defibs. Just to let the world know who you are, Andy. Andy is a football commentator, well, sports commentator in general, and you currently work for Sky Sports Radio, is that right?
Predominantly football, believe it or not, over here with SBS and Fox Sports when pay TV started. More recently, as one of the lead commentators in the emerging Indian Super League. So I've got to work with a lot of people from your part of the world. But firstly, I love the connection, because I had a meeting yesterday with the CEO of the Heart Foundation of Australia. Our charity is aligned with FIFA with a sudden death registry unit. They started looking at this in 2014 released a report at Christmas, used a lot of our data. We were recognised for the data because we had 15 deaths from 2014 to 15. We only had three saves, but after that, three deaths the next 3 years, 14 saves. Now, when Amanda touched on, and she should be very proud of this, by getting that defib, and sadly the legacy of Mickey Dean has to live on, a defibrillator saved a player at that same ground a year later.
Wow.
And this year we've had five incidents, five players saved, three because defibrillators were there. The other one, the defibrillator didn't work, which is a no-no, obviously. And the other, they couldn't find the defib, but thankfully all five footballers saved. And overall, to give you a clearer picture, and we talk about international players, four Socceroos have undergone heart surgery. And the most recent is a player that you would know, and Tony Vidmar's in that group, John Aloisi, ex-Coventry Portsmouth, has had heart surgery.
That's incredible, isn't it? What really hits me more than anything else about this is the numbers are so freaky. For example, in my own job, I know that we... I'm trying not to advertise my job here because this isn't the place for us, but I know that we placed a defib in a supermarket in East Anglia a few years ago, and it was used that afternoon.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the stats. So, you know, we don't want to scaremonger people here, or that if anyone takes anything from this, it's please get CPR. Get CPR trained.
That's what I want, absolutely.
But I wonder if you could tell me about the tents you had outside the ground after Mickey's death, where the people were just doing random tests.
Yeah. What we're doing here with the Victor Chang, who's a preeminent leader in the space, the Institute there, they're very closely aligned with the Heart Foundation. We go out to clubs, and with the support of the Liverpool FC, New South Wales Supporters Club, and other philanthropists and whatnot, what we do is we go out and we do a three-part test, which is unique. We take their blood sample on the spot. We tell them their blood sugar and cholesterol and also their blood pressure. What we're seeing this season is a rise, and it's COVID-related, inactivity.
Yeah.
A lot of footballers in their 30s and 40s and 50s think they're 18 again. There's an increase of 38%. 72%, it's up to 38% of people tested have been advised to go straight to their GP and get a thorough checkup.
Now, just again, because I really don't want to scare people about this, but that's a standard response when a doctor sees something even slightly wrong, not sort of you're going to die in the next 10 minutes. It is just that, look, your numbers are high. You might want to look at this. So we should say that straight away. It's not sort of like,
not scary. Look, I'm 58. I take blood pressure medication, cholesterol medication, and I'm a sleep apnea sufferer. But I've changed my diet, my lifestyle. I get regular checkups. So, you know, I think more than anything, the education and awareness that those marquee tents create at grassroots football, because it's the foundation of our game anywhere in the world. That's where the big numbers are, and that's where most incidents are. I mean, in Christian's case, defibrillation, CPR, onto him within 2 minutes in that environment where the first aid is first class, as we know, the actions obviously are going to happen very quickly. And with a defib and CPR, it's up to 70% chance of survival in a cardiac arrest.
Yeah, and those are really, really impressive, you know, figures when you think just how much things have changed in the past 10, 15 years.
Yes.
Sorry, Amanda.
The education side of things, and I think, Carl, like the tent that LFC New South Wales last provided at a club called Hills Hawk, there was a great piece put up on social media from a young player. He must have been 20 years old, and he had the test. He couldn't believe how fast the test was, what it was providing, he hadn't thought about this until being presented with the opportunity to be able to have that done. He's a 20-year-old kid running around and fit, and he articulated it so well, what he thought were the benefits of having this sort of testing available at a grassroots level.
Yeah, it is an extraordinary thing. I think you already touched on something as well, Andy, which comes into this, is so a 20-year-old kid would play like a 20-year-old kid because that's what I would do. I'm 52 myself, and I'm pretty sure my 25th birthday is coming up soon. So, you know, I'm far too old for the things I do, shall we say. Because we hear a lot about why are footballers, why are they screened every single day? You know, every doctor knows every one of their numbers. They know how fast they run. They know what they eat. They know their VO2 max, things like that. How is it that they're having heart problems?
I think it's age. And look, we know a lot of these incidents are genetic. I'm a firm believer as you get older, I believe that in the perfect world, that every seniors player should have a medical checkup before they can register. So they've been to their doctor, their GP, they've been checked and off they go. They've got a green ticket to basically go ahead. I think senior games should be reduced, let's be honest, from 90 minutes to say 60 or 70 minutes. I think
you haven't seen my senior game. Mantra extended to
25. I, you know, in the perfect world, and it's something I'd love to try and get across the line through the FIFA registry and globally. And look, I know he's not from the right side of Liverpool. He is my global ambassador, Tim Cahill. He's been an unbelievable worker behind the scenes for me. But I would love us, imagine if we can unite, say, Australia and England become the first countries in the world that have a heart health awareness round of football throughout the top level of the Premiership, which 2000 defibs, the Premier League have set the benchmark straight away. That's fantastic. Yeah. I think other federations around the world have to follow. But imagine if we had a heart health weekend that it would funnel from EPL down to all the various leagues, all the way down to the grassroots. It creates awareness, education, dialogue. It's a topic we should be talking about because when it happens, look, it happened to one of my mates on the same day we were playing together. I lost a mate that I played junior reps football with a couple of weeks prior. Then I lost a mate that I was playing 35s football with. The way you react, what to do, the confusion, no defib, where's the ambulance? You know, CPR and defibs have to work together. We have to be educated. We have to have people prepared to use them. And in the perfect world, first responders should be referees, but they have enough on their plate, as we know.
Of course, yeah.
There's still lots to be done in this space. And I remember having a good chat with Russell Osman two seasons ago in India when he lost his mate Cyril Regis. And you remember how hard and tough Russell was as a footballer.
Absolutely, yeah.
A man's man and one of my best mates. To see him tear up and grab me and shake me literally and say, you keep doing what you're doing in Australia. We all need to do this. And it gives you that reinforcement that what you're doing is right. It is confronting. You see some of the results and you see the confusion and the concern of players. But you know what? It's not just senior players. It doesn't discriminate. This can be an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old.
Yeah,
we had a semi-professional footballer of African background, Kodjo Ajasu, 24 years old, a school teacher, 26. Kiki Nurmov, who was playing for Sydney FC in the A-League, signs in Spain a three-year deal.
Yeah.
And they paraded him to the press thinking he's a 20-year-old kid. Deal, bang, proper checks, retired within 48 hours, career gone, finished at 20. But he lives to tell the story,
Career gone, but at least he gets to talk about it. Yeah, that's the big thing for me. We are running out of time. If the Heartbeat of Football could have one final aim, what would it be?
A defibrillator at every football ground, both here and globally. They are look, I can't stress enough how much in the event of a cardiac arrest or a heart attack, you've got to give them every chance of survival.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much for this. Really appreciate it.
The last eight then of the Euros, back with Chloe, with Harriet and with Andy. They are intriguingly poised. We'll get the misery gut stuff out the way early, Andy, me and you especially. Standard shite, can't get over it, to be honest with you. Really, certain games, certain moments. This is why, without sort of making it England-focused or not England-focused, I think the England manager's actually done a really good job of sort of thinking we can just stay in games, not have to work that hard to do it, and then back the fact that one of our lads will kick it in the goal towards the end because they're quite good. I thought that you got to see that against the German side, who had some very good players. The organisation's what I think's lacking. I couldn't believe how poor the Netherlands were in their exit to the Czech side. There's a few other games where I'm just looking at it, and as you said before, the time some of these players have got to pick the passes and play football, it would not be tolerated. Even at championship level in this country, in the Bundesliga, in Serie A, these sides, they all look a bit undercooked to me, and that's why I think it's wide open.
Yeah, probably why Italy and England looked the most likely left in to win it, because of the teams the least likely to make a mistake. I think everyone's goose is cooked. They're just knackered. But the parallel of that is we've seen some madly entertaining games as well. We've seen some really good, and not to say the standard. So high quality football isn't always entertaining. Actually, quite the opposite most of the time.
No, I couldn't agree more.
But because the situation we're in, everyone's half fit. We've seen some absolutely crackers games that I've thoroughly enjoyed. But you are right. It's a case of who can be the most disciplined, who can blink first. I think it's telling that both. Italy have conceded one goal, haven't they, all tournament. England are yet to concede. I think it says to me, and there's been a load of late goals, and whether it's a physicality issue where the England's attitude and Italy's attitude is just stay in this, keep it level for however long, and you know let them run themselves into the ground, and then straight. I think it was notable England's two goals came at the time they did against Germany the other day. They picked the moment. It was a conscious thing, and it worked for them.
On this, on the Belgium-Portugal game in the same way, Belgium have only conceded one goal as well. And Harriet, I was watching the Belgium-Portugal game and I couldn't believe how sapped everybody's legs were, to the point that I almost got the impression teammates were annoyed with one another if they put a sprint on. Like, I can't keep up with you there. You've got to go a little bit slower. And it, the game just completely peters out. It becomes a game of fouls. It becomes a game that's easily broken up. No one.
Is this why Mbappe has the tournament? He does.
I don't think it helps him at all.
Sorry to interrupt.
I think there's a few players who've really struggled with it, and they've struggled with it structurally as well. And that's this Belgium side for me. They do well against Portugal. They just get ahead and they just go, we're just going to keep you at arm's length. And there's the one effort that hits the post. I have a feeling that there's going to be a bit of reality that sort of hits a few of these sides. I suspect the last 16 may well be the most fun games, because I think everyone's going to do a bit of a, we can just stick our oar into these games now and see where they end up.
Yeah, kind of to echo Andy, I was not looking forward to the Euros that much, and I've just loved the games purely because the standard's been quite low and it's just been a bit mad, hasn't it? And actually some of the goals have been great, but
yeah.
Belgium are an interesting one because obviously De Bruyne came back in and then they looked like they were kind of flying again for a little period of time, and they haven't been that sort of functional. They've just been sort of trying to be a bit more sort of going for the flair side of things and seeing how it works out. And obviously so far it's been all right for them. I think they're going to have a bit of a sort of reality is going to come down on them against Italy, because Italy have looked like the only team at the moment that can actually go on and win it. From my perspective anyway, I think some people are still saying that England have a shout. I think the whole tactical masterclass thing from Southgate is just not, you know, in my opinion, absolutely wrong, because I don't think he knew that, you know, when Grealish was going to come on at 70, he was going to have that big of an impact, and he was very lucky that he did. So yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I think for England, the draw's fallen very, very nicely for them, hasn't it? So they've got Ukraine, and then if who do they play? If
Czech Republic
or Denmark. Yes, I mean, they've definitely got the nice side of the draw and every chance of getting to the final.
I think both sides of the draw is very easy. I think you've got Italy, Belgium. It's the best matchup that England could have asked for, because one of them have to go out. 100%. On that side, one of them had to go out anyway. But at least now, you know, with this being the last 16 game, you know, you can prepare. Even though they'll take it one game at a time, if England don't beat Ukraine and then Czech Republic or Denmark, they've had a shocker.
Fancy the Danes, you know.
I hope they do, but I reckon it would be a massive I reckon Southgate should be sacked. I don't care for England, but I just think that England should reach the final as a minimum, and they should win it. And if they don't, I think that, like, you're never going to get a chance like this again to win that.
Well, they're never going to get a chance like this, but then I think that, for instance, the Danish equivalent of saying the same thing. They won it in 92, Andy, and in odd circumstances. There's been odd circumstances this time. They were great against Wales for 70 minutes, Denmark. It's probably the best all-round performance anyone's put in, and it is only Wales at that stage of the competition, and Wales looked shot. But the Danes look handy. They look really handy.
Well, even before they get to Denmark, and you're putting the cart before the horse a little bit there, we're at the stage of the tournament where, all right, if you look at it on paper in the bookies, I'll tell you, England are on the easy side of the draw, but they're facing teams who've got nothing to lose now.
I couldn't agree more.
They've got nothing to lose, and for all this, we'll let them run the legs out. Ukraine could just throw the kitchen sink at it. and see what happens.
And Ukraine can decide that they're going to just let England run the legs out, yeah, because the pressure will be on England to make the game. Ukraine can just say, we'll sit here, we'll do what you've been doing to other teams, and if you're happy with it being 0-0 on 70, we're happy with it being 0-0 on 70, and let's just throw some dice.
And there's an example of that. So everyone's going crazy about how great England are. The last 10 minutes of the England-Scotland game, England were absolutely shit in a fucking brick.
Yeah.
So Ukraine sit on it for 70, 75. Doubt starts creeping in. Nerves starts creeping in. Where is the game against Ukraine?
It's in Rome.
In Rome. No home crowd there either. So you just don't know. I don't think it's a sure thing that England get through past Ukraine. Not as sure a thing as what people are saying. Yeah. And as you said, Denmark have got it in the locker. And Denmark have also got the experience.
I think it's really open. There's not a result in any of the games that would surprise me, Harriet. And I think that's a credit to the tournament and the way in which it's played out at this point. But it wouldn't surprise me if Switzerland got something out of Spain. Belgium, Italy could go either way. I do think the Italians do look the strongest side, and I'm very into anything that Gianluca Vialli does. Czech Republic, Denmark could go either way, but I do like the Danes. Ukraine, England, you'd expect England to win. But I think it is a remarkably open tournament at this point.
Yeah, it's really open. I think, like you said, there's nothing that would really surprise me that much, other than maybe if Ukraine beat England. But at the same time, Ukraine are coming into that now knowing exactly what England are probably going to do, because they've done the same thing in every game. Just sort of, they know who the threats are now. They know that Sterling's really, Kane's not on his top form, so they know that Sterling's really the only big attacking threat. So they're going to come into it probably feeling quite confident. I think, you know, the big shock with me was obviously when Switzerland beat France the other day, and that was a bit, you know, that was the sort of giant killing, wasn't it? But apart from that, it's been pretty open playing field. I'm all up for a Shaqiri masterclass to knock Spain out, bump his price out, see what happens.
Chloe spent it.
Chloe spent it.
Was the result a surprise, or was the performance a surprise? Because I thought Switzerland deserved that, and I thought they were unlucky, especially when they missed the penalty. And the mental fortitude, what I was really impressed with, they missed the penalty. They go 2-1 down, and you think at that point France are going to do 4-5 here.
Probably a shot before the ball was kicked, but when you actually saw how Switzerland played during the 90, it was a fair result, I would say. Yeah.
Once that Rodriguez, I think it was, who missed the pen, I was absolutely fuming him, but my Christ, imagine if he did win the pen and it didn't unravel the way that it did. Yeah. We would have lost a very good game, and I think, to be fair, that's one of the sparks of this Euros, I guess, and the fact that I just loved it when Pogba scored and he thought like he was just sound. He thought that it was comfortable. It was 3-1.
He'd text Harrison and everything.
Yeah, he'd text Harrison COD tonight. And, you know, it was like they relaxed and they thought, 3-1, we've done this. And Switzerland had other things in mind. Switzerland knew that it's a knockout tournament. You can't switch off like that. It's at a top level football. You can't do stuff like that. You will be, you know, murdered by the opposition.
What's interesting is that the Spanish pulled through and the French couldn't. The same thing happened to the Spanish, and they pulled through, they pulled together, and it was a great finish for Morata. Okay, who's going to win it?
Switzerland.
Are going to win the Euros?
Well,
that's, I'm fine with that. I like it. I want to feel shouts.
You know, this right, here's my thought process. Shaqiri scores the winning goal in the 90th minute in the final, bumps him up by like 10 million, and then, you know, Liverpool have a bit more leeway if someone wants to buy him.
I mean, you are very much willing the thing you want to be into being. Andy, who's going to win it?
The winner of Portugal-Italy.
Belgium-Italy.
Belgium-Italy, yeah.
Belgium-Italy.
I'm going to go with the exact same. I'm going to hedge my bets on Belgium. See what happens.
If we're being honest, England will win it, and that's what. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Okay. I think I think a final will be very, very tricky for England to negotiate against whoever it was. And I also am genuinely, if I haven't looked at the betting market, but I would be absolutely fine if my any stake money of mine ended up on Denmark. Absolutely fine with that. Okay, we'll be back in a minute to have a chat about Rafa Benitez. Welcome back, Rafa Benitez, then. Who's heartbroken? You heartbroken?
I don't know whether it's gutted. I don't know whether it's annoyed. I don't know what I feel, but it's not good, like, to be honest.
Are you livid with him? You aren't mad with him? Are you mad with the Blue Brethren? Who's upset you?
Here's the thing. I was like 9, 10 when he went to Chelsea. So, like, at that stage, I loved football, but I probably wasn't... I didn't care for it enough. Now... I just couldn't see Jurgen Klopp or anyone else going to Everton like that. And people keep saying to me in the 80s it was an own thing, but I wasn't born in the 80s, and I'd be livid if I was, and that happened then.
It was all right, you know.
was it decent, yeah?
It was all right, yeah. Rainbow, Rod, Jane and Freddie and all that.
You're fine with Everton players going to Liverpool and Liverpool going to Everton?
As long as we get the best ones, on the whole, I am. Nick Barmby was great. It was one of the best days.
Yeah, fair enough. But for me with Rafa, I'll never forget what he's done for the club outside of football, and what he's done for Hillsborough and stuff like that. But at this moment, I do not want him to win a single game.
So I'm fine. I'll come back to you quick on that, because I'm fine with not wanting him to win a single game. I think I'm also, in fact, I actively don't want him to win a single game, because that's the point. He's now managing Everton. But like, I'm sort of all right with him making the decision, because he's got to have a job somewhere. And I mean, my ideal world still remains, he goes and becomes Tranmere manager, because it's even closer to his.
But he could buy the club, couldn't he?
Yeah, and he could maybe even...
Who would he argue with over transfers?
Well, you'd have to bring in like a fake fella, like a blow-up doll to have murder with, like, or something. A mirror, yeah. My biggest concern is the idea, Chloe, that he'd make them successful to some degree. I don't like that at all, because I respect the man massively. But apart from that, I'm managing to be quite calm about it.
I think it's more of the fact that, you know, he's got he's on a flag on the cop.
That is,
you know,
true.
He's literally with the likes of Jurgen Klopp, Bill Shankly, Bob Paisley, these people who have made the club who they are and will forever be written in Liverpool history. For someone who's gave us Istanbul, which is arguably, I know we've won the Premier League, but that is arguably one of, along with Barcelona,
it's a defining moment.
Yeah, it's a defining moment, one of the greatest games you will ever see, not just for Liverpool, but in the world. And you talk about professional footballers, and you know, when they do interviews on the Champions League, they always talk about Istanbul. It's the game they talk about, whether they play for City, United, whoever they play for, they talk about that one game. And for him to then manage Everton, potentially win trophies, it's just not for me.
How are you feeling?
I think, I don't know, I think there's two sort of sides at the moment, aren't they? People that are, you know, angry, and people that are being a bit more sort of rational about it. I'm not saying either is right or wrong. People can feel how they want to feel.
In other words, you're right.
I just feel somewhere like a bit more in the middle. I was kind of fine with that. I think I talked about it on Talking Reds a couple of weeks ago, that it kind of makes sense for him. He's 61 now. He wants to stay in Liverpool. He wants to be with his friends and family, and he wants to work still. So Liverpool, Liverpool don't want him back. He's never going to come back to Liverpool. I think he knows that. He's wanted to come back on numerous occasions, and that hasn't worked out. So for him, he's thinking, well, I want one more job before I retire, so why not? But it was weird seeing him with Everton, a scarf around his neck. That is what I will say. That was strange.
It was weird. I've really enjoyed seeing his slightly avuncular chats with Duncan Ferguson. That struck me as odd. It's very Italian, Andy. I think it's very much the way in which managerial sort of careers work in Italy, that people end up managing a lot of different clubs. And the idea of identifying within just one, no matter what level of success you talk about, is actually relatively rare. Ancelotti himself, for instance, you know, he's managed a few different places. I think it's very, very Italian.
Yeah, it's a bit of a... I mean, I'm still reeling from Chloe calling me a dinosaur.
I meant no harm.
She meant some harm.
Yeah, no, it was the invective in which it was delivered. Yeah, look, it's we all know Rafa is a professional, and I can understand completely why he's took the job. And I wouldn't say I'm happy about it. I mean, I'm content. I'm enjoying it, just because. But I think it'd be a good appointment for Evan. And I'll tell you why.
I'll tell you why.
He becomes a lightning rod for them. And if it starts well, so basically you're faced with two scenarios, and this isn't having to go with Evertonians. I've got friends with Evertonians, and they'll freely admit to the atmosphere at Goodison can be toxic, even at the best of times. So let's just say that's already there, and it's either Mascheri's fault, or it's Ken Wright's fault, or it's Alex Iwobi's fault, or it's whoever's fault. Suddenly it's only ever one person's fault. There's one focus now, and it's the fella who's in the dugout. And Rafa Benitez's his biggest strength is that he relishes that.
Oh, he's the thickest skin man who's ever lived.
Oh, yeah. So it's not that he's got a thick skin and it'll wash off from me. He actively encourages that. He thrives. That's his energy.
Yeah. I think there's fairness in that, Andy. What I would say about it is I feel as though it would be a really good appointment if you could take the neutrality stuff, you know what I mean? Like,
if he was a different manager and his name wasn't Rafa Benitez and he'd won the European Cup for, fucking Aston Villa or whatever, then they'd be singing from the rooftops, but he's not. But I think that adds to it.
I think it adds the spice. What I would say is I think what'll be difficult is when, for instance, let's even say he starts well, but for me, what would worry me is what happens in December when in a five-game spell, they lose four and draw one. And that's where I think, like, Rafa can not just block this stuff out, but as you say, absorb it and turn it into energy. It's possible the players can't do that as well. It's possible the hierarchy of the club finds that difficult. It's possible the coaching staff finds that difficult. That Rafa is able just to go, I am doing the job that is in front of me. Watch me do it. So, you've got to bring people with you in that, even in a, without sort of getting into the other aspects of a conversation about Benitez's man management.
But so that I think that, again, I'm not too overly concerned. In fact, I quite enjoy Everton, so I have a miserable December.
Oh, yes, so would I.
But for Rafa to have taken the job and for it to have taken a couple of weeks of negotiations, you would imagine he's been given certain assurances. What was telling is that Marcel Brand's name wasn't on any of the statements yesterday that come out. And even when he was being linked with the job, I had a little text exchange from a mutual friend when this isn't going to end well for one of them. And I don't think it's going to be Rafael Benitez. And Rafa, stubborn as he is, and I read a comment elsewhere, to, you know, I can't wait till in January till he proves a point by playing, I think it was Dominic Calvert-Lewin at left back because Ken Wright wouldn't get him a fullback. Because he's literally, and you talk about the players not settling for it, but you're talking about, again, a man who gives no fuck around players, and he'll literally come in, and because he's the new appointment, he'll have to stick to go to the players. You either go with it.
Well, that's why I think they've got him in, but I think there's other reasons why they've got him in. I'll just end with you on this one, Andy. At some point, the Blues are going to have to engage with the Usmanov reality.
But we'll get on to the Usmanov thing in a minute. But the interesting thing is, Roman Abramovich could not speak more highly of Rafael Benitez. This is a fella who he sacked, by the way.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, said he would have kept on. And it was Abramovich who Usmanov sought the counsel of when he was talking about Rafa. If you remember, the original reason why Rafa was bought into Chelsea was to root out John Terry.
Clear house.
Never got the opportunity, despite winning the UEFA Cup. Which brings me to my last point. As much as they hate him, now, there's going to be some Evertonians. So I was talking to a good mate at the weekend, and he said there's going to be three tranches of Everton. Same way there's like a million tranches of Liverpool fans. You have the ones who've got an open mind about it right now. Not happy, but, you know. You've got the ones who are against it, who can be won over. And you've got the ones who, whatever he does, sounds familiar, this, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Whatever he does, whatever he wins for them, they'll hate him, right? But if you're ever, Everton Football Club haven't won a trophy since 1995, Rafa Benitez's stock in trade is winning knockout competitions. Undeniable, right? So what does it do for Everton? Everton Football Club are trying to re-establish themselves as a force. That's fair. That isn't having to go up a little in them, right? Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine he gets them even a League Cup.
Well, he should target the League Cup.
A League Cup or an FA Cup or get, you know, how much does that do for Everton as a club? And even if the happy arrangement is, he comes in two seasons, wins him a trophy, elevates them a little bit.
European run,
and then they shake hands and go, thanks very much. Anyway, Usmanov.
I'm just intrigued by it. Very, very quickly, Mashiri and Usmanov, neither of them are on the board. Brands is on the board. It's one of the reasons why I think this has stuck a little bit. But this is where things end up. If you take the money and say that there's going to be a Merseyside power shift, you end up, Andy, in a situation where you can't control what the money will want to do. And the money doesn't even exist in public sight.
Yeah, and I think this is what you get when you have singular owners, or when I say singular, like partnerships, or instead of having an investment group like Fenway Sports Group, and that isn't saying Fenway Perfect by any chance. When you are funded by an individual, and let's put Mashiri and Usmanov in one.
Yeah.
However that entity is made up of, you're then subject to the whims of that party. So you can put the best laid plans into place. Sorry if I'm whistling on. You put the best laid plans into place. You can bring your Marcel Brands in, you can, whatever. We saw it at Liverpool with Damien Comoli.
Yeah.
There's so many parallels here. Where, apart from the investment strategy thing, whereas, all right, so you get rid of Ancelotti and Brands has gone, right, I'll do this. And you give him the opportunity to come up with four names, and Mashiri goes, or eight names, 10 names, whatever. And then Mashiri goes, well, what about this fella? And if your mind's already set.
Yep.
You know, you're already fighting an uphill battle. And Chris Bascombe wrote something excellent on the subject in the Telegraph yesterday when saying, he said, for me, and if you speak to people who know Rafa, and bear in mind, Chris isn't Rafa's biggest fan, he said, as soon as Mashiri met Rafa, that was all it was going to be, because Rafa Benitez is the perfect salesman. He would have gone into that meeting, perfectly researched, would have told things that made Mashiri's light up that he wouldn't have even considered. And that was it. He was only ever going to get it if it was on his terms. And then, unfortunately, for Everton and the setup that they want to put in, it just doesn't correlate with the model that they've got. And I think you're going to see I can't say I think this doesn't end well for Brand, because basically what they've said is the board's totally ineffective. It's basically a showboard, if you will.
It is indeed, but it's been a show. Thank you very much indeed to Andy and Carl for earlier on, Andy Heaton, Harriet Pryor and Chloe Bloxham here. Check out the Anfield Wrap, do subscribe, do download the app. We are closer towards the end of the Euros. Very soon Liverpool might even announce their pre-season fixtures. People's schedules and plans rely upon them. Anyway, that's my pleading for now. We'll be back with more Weekend of next week, Anfield Wrap, and there is more from the Anfield Wrap to come, both on subscription stuff, and there'll be extra free stuff next week, which I will detail in Monday's show. See you later.
Sports Social Podcast Network.